Okay, Alan's got us all lined up there, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. So I'm going to mute all. As per usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so to ask a question or make a comment, please remute yourself afterwards to keep background noise down. If I see somebody's unmuted themselves and they're allowing background noise to continue, I will unceremoniously mute you. Don't be insulted. We're just trying to keep it that everybody can hear what's going on. So welcome all to the May 27th Q&A session of the Ottawa PC User Group. We got a bunch of material tonight, so I'll hand it off to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away.
Okay, so we have a couple of interesting things to start with. One is going way back in time. This is Dave Plummer, retired Microsoft software engineer. You notice this is a YouTube tech video. It could also be a Looney Link because it turns out Dave Plummer is a Saskatchewan boy. And this is an interesting, if you're interested in programming, this is an interesting video because he's talking about his experience basically as a school child and coming to programming through BASIC and Radio Shack computers and Commodores, that kind of thing. So it's kind of a look back in time at programming. And then going the other way, you may have seen at our May monthly meeting, we had the Geeks panel. And one of the questions was really interesting, that computers had changed in the last 60 years, and what did the panel foresee coming in future? There were quite a few points raised on that. Interestingly enough, another of my favorite video people, this is Chris Barnett from Explaining Computers, and he this week did this video, The Future of Home Computing, where he's basically looking at that same question, and perhaps not taking it quite so far in the future as we did on the Geeks panel, but looking at probably the near to medium term of computing and suggesting that probably desktops are going away and mini PCs are going to be the wave of the future. Anyway, if you're interested in that kind of stuff, it's really quite an interesting video. And then the final thing I have coming from the Geek panel again was this question of there's so much going on in the computing world. How do you keep up to date? And what resources do you regularly follow? So again, there were a number of suggestions. And interesting, in the chat, there were a number of suggestions also. And Cal from Durham, the Durham Club, pointed out he gets a item called Tech News on his cell phone. And Dennis suggested going to the library and looking at magazines like PC World. Marvo had things on YouTube, and especially Ask Leo and Cybertech CPU were things that he was interested in. And then Stuart had mentioned a number of things on mobile, these two websites here for mobile phones, and then more general things to make use of and the notebook check and websites. And it turns out I had actually mentioned the library because that's one of the things I actually do look at. So I just thought I'd take a quick look at how to access these magazines in the library, because I never think that using the library's website is terribly straightforward. So here we are on the main homepage of the library. And what we need to do is to scroll down the page and find this section called Online Resources. And in particular, you want to look at that Read window and pick out digital magazines. That's what we're interested in, and electronic magazines. And again, you have to scroll down because there's all kinds of magazines there, Consumer Reports and things like that. But what I'm more interested in is the Overdrive set of magazines, which used to be called Zinio. And that's where we used to get PC Magazine, PC World, that kind of thing. I think PC Magazine has gone to just a web-based system now, but other computer magazines are still available. So if you go to the Overdrive magazines, then you'll find that you can read the New Yorker and the New Scientist and all kinds of weird and wonderful things. To find computer magazines, one of the things you can do is just hit that search button, and then you have to think of something to search for. And one of the things I search for is PC, because I know that there's PC World, and I know that there's Maximum PC. And I would just caution you here that you may want to avoid things like PC Magazine, PC Go, down near the bottom here, unless you understand German, because it turns out that is a German language publication. So if you're an Anglophone like me, then that's not terribly useful to you. And there's another one somewhere in there, which is a Chinese language. I think that's the PC Pro one. So there's a number of magazines there which are not in English. If you know what you're looking for, like PC World, you can search for PC World and then you'll find it instantly. And you can look for computer and stuff like that. Another way to do it is to apply a filter. So here, in the left-hand menu here, there are filters, and if you go down there to the subject, I've picked out tech and gaming, and I've applied that filter here, and you can see now you've got a whole bunch of technological-type magazines which are available for you to read. And when you do that, when you select one, so here I'm going back to PC World, you have to borrow it. And of course, in the library being what it is, you can't just borrow it. It's much more complicated than that. So although I'm signed in to my library account, what it wants me to do now is sign in again. And I have a choice of various libraries. So I've chosen the Ottawa Public Library. I have to put my card number and my PIN in and then sign in once again. And then once I do that, of course, the next thing I have to do is borrow this magazine again. If you remember, I borrowed it previously, well, now I'm borrowing it again. You can never have too many buttons to press twice on the library's website, turns out. Anyway, if you choose to borrow it, then you can actually choose to borrow it for a number of days, a week, 2 weeks, or 21 days. And now, guess what? You press the borrow button. And finally, you've checked it out. So it's checked out now for 3 weeks. I can now read it in the browser. So here we are on the first front page, the cover page of the magazine. So if we scroll through the magazine, we'll find that there are some articles, some reviews, for example. And typically the reviews are proprietary software. So here they're trying to push a PDF reader, Adobe Acrobat. And some of us don't use Adobe Acrobat anymore, so that's not terribly useful for me. But here's one, how to make your PC feel new again with no upgrades required. So a whole bunch of things that you can do just by tweaking various settings and things on your existing system. If you actually right click on a page like that, then you get a whole bunch of other things. You got these icons up here, for example, for this one right here, the A, the capital A, will allow you to change the font. So if you have a tiny font that you can't really read very well, then you can make it larger by hitting that guy. And there are some other things there as well. And you can browse the page using the film strip here. And when you're done, it doesn't take me 3 weeks to read these magazines. And when you're done, you can go back to the loans page and hit the return button, and that will send it back so somebody else can actually read it. So there you go. That's how to, a quick and dirty on maybe how to access a digital magazine from the Ottawa Public Library. Okay, so next up is a keyboard shortcut from you-know-who.
Yes, keyboard shortcut number 12, so permanently deleting files. So It's going to behave on me, and it's not. Try again. There we go. Okay, everybody knows that if you go into File Explorer and you highlight a file, you can delete it by just pressing the delete key, or probably people know that rather than having to go to a menu option to do that. But what happens when you do that is it actually sends it to the recycle bin. So then you have to deal with it again when you decide you're going to empty the recycle bin. The recycle bin can be very useful, so if you accidentally delete something, you can get it back, but it does end up just moving it to another area on your storage, and again, you end up having to deal with it again. So what if you're sure you never want to recover this particular file? And if that's the case, what you can actually do is hold down the Shift key and hit Delete, and you'll get a pop-up asking, are you sure you want to permanently delete this file? Hit Enter or click Yes, and then the file is gone, and it doesn't get sent to the recycle bin. So I use this all the time. I very rarely send anything to the recycle bin. And so if you're like-minded that when you delete something, you never want to recover it, Shift-Delete rather than do Delete. And that's it for the keyboard shortcut number 12. And I think the next one's me, too.
Yeah, Tom has a comment, though. He says permanent delete keystroke also works in many other programs displaying file lists.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of other... Yeah, file lists and file managers, they will mimic a lot of the capabilities of File Explorer. So it could well work in other places as well. Anything that can make it faster for you.
So the next item is yours, Chris, indeed.
Yes, okay. So the next one, Mailstorm. This is a really cool program. And I don't know when this program actually came out. I must have been asleep or something, because it hits on so many levels of problem areas for people. So, you know, what if you could do these following things? Archive all your mail from multiple mail providers so that you have a local copy, a backup copy of all your email. Most major providers of email, no problem. It's just you put in your email address. It'll figure everything out, and it'll do things for you. Even if that doesn't work, a lot of the mail providers where it doesn't work will provide support through either POP or IMAP, and I strongly suggest using IMAP in this case in order to be able to archive that mail. It can take mail directly from locally installed clients. So if you use Outlook locally or Thunderbird or SeaMonkey, it can actually go and cull the email out of there and archive it. Or Exchange Server. Or a PST file. That's something that a lot of people have come up to me in the past and they say, well, they used to be on Microsoft Outlook and it uses PST files and all their mail is in this PST file and now they no longer use Outlook and how do they access all those old emails? Well, what if you could access the PST files? Or individual message files, either EML files or MSG files. Or MBOX format files, which is a way that a lot of mail systems with local mail systems like Thunderbird, they use MBOX format for their files. So you could actually point to an MBOX file and get all your emails out of there. What if you could access all of those archived emails for reading and printing? Access attachments in them, just like you were accessing your live mail system. What if you could search all your archived emails across all of those mailboxes that you have, including using wildcards, exclusions, phrases, and searching within attachments? What if you could restore missing and corrupted emails in your original mail store from your archive? What if you could easily move email from one email provider to another? So you change from using Rogers.com email address, and you decide, oh, I'm going to go over to Bell, and you cancel your ISP contract with Rogers. And the day you cancel it, they delete all your email. Well, you don't want to lose those thousands of emails. What if you could actually preserve all of those, move them either just to local where you can access them, or actually move them to another mail system, like move them to your Google Gmail account? And what if you could use it as either a regular installable program or a portable app? So anybody who knows about portable apps, good on you, and you know the value of that. If you don't know about portable apps, just don't worry about it. and you could do it all for free. You know, that sounds like a tall order of being able to do all of these things that, as I say, touch the pain points for an awful lot of people. So you download the program, MailStore Home, and when you run the program, it comes up with this screen. And one thing I would suggest to you is that the first thing you do is check that box that's in the middle, or click on it, which says you want to index email attachments contents. And if you don't do that, then it will not be able to allow you to search in the email attachments. I suggest that most people probably in their searching, they want to be able to search attachments as well. So if you click that right off the bat, you'll get it. If you forget to do that, you can do it later on. It'll just have to rebuild the index at that point in time. So, but if you do it up front, any index that gets built will include indexing of the attachments. So once you've done that, what do you do? Oh, sorry. Yeah, there's one other click. Is when you click on that, it'll actually come up with a list of file types that it can actually index for attachments. And it essentially will do anything that has an iFilter installed on your computer. So if you have Microsoft Office installed, there will be an iFilter for Microsoft Word, PowerPoint, Excel, things like that. If you've installed OpenOffice, there will be an iFilter there for the OpenOffice format files and so forth. You will automatically get plain text, HTML and HTML files, as well as PDF files, Acrobat file formats. So those will automatically be there, but you may have additional types that can be indexed as well. So once you get through that, what do? Well, you want to archive your email. That's the first thing you have to do, is ingest mail from a mail server. So you click on Archive Email, and then it comes up with this screen. And so right now they have this area over here for profiles, and we've got no profile yet. We're going to build a profile. So the easiest way is you just put in your email address in that box and then click Start. In most cases, that's all you will need to do for it to set itself up so that it can actually go to the particular mail server to get the mail. So it looks at the domain name, you know, if it's gmail.com or rogers.com or whatever. It'll just know the settings that are required for it to be able to ingest the email. You can go to the advanced, and that'll let you choose a specific mail server type, but usually it'll figure it out by itself. If it doesn't work automatically, so it comes back and says, well, we can't figure this out for this particular mail server, you might have to actually select using IMAP, and then you'll have to get the provider's parameters for the server name, the port that's going to be used, and some things like that. So you can get the IMAP settings if you just Google on, you know, what's the IMAP settings for Rogers email or Simpatico email or whatever. I did need to do, in one of the ingestions on it, I had to go to advanced and tell it was Gmail because I wanted to bring in the email from my chris.taylor@opcug.ca account. It didn't know that opcug.ca is actually Gmail, and there are some particular things that are needed for Gmail, so I had to actually go in and tell it that was actually a Gmail account. In most cases, you won't have to do that. So then you have to enter the password for your email so that it can actually pick up the mail, log in as you. Most likely, you won't have to do any manual configuration on it. If it fails, you can go into the manually configure, and there is help on their website on what you'd have to put in that area. If it is Gmail, Gmail by default does not allow a program to access your email. So in this case, you have to authorize that. And so if it is a Gmail account, you go click on the activation required and click on the the authorize button. And then it'll bring you over to Google, and Google will say, oh, this program, MailStore Home, wants to access your Google account, and you have to allow it. So you just say, yeah, sure, go ahead. Then you can customize a few other things. So you can say, oh, I only want to bring in the mail from certain periods of time, or you know, something like that. Most people, the defaults are going to work just perfectly fine there. But you can bring in a subset of your mail if you want to. Click on the finish. It'll come up, and it'll say that it's created a profile for that particular mailbox. And so all you have to do is double-click on it in the profile section to start archiving. So when you click on that, it'll come up, and in this case here, I had it go out to my Gmail account, and it ingested 3,723 items in under 10 minutes. So pretty fast, and it just had to come back. It had a progress bar, so I could go and wait and have lunch if it was going really slowly or whatever. I created a second archive for my National Capital Freenet mailbox and ingested the mail from that. So some mail servers may require what's known as an app password rather than your regular password for your email. And if that's the case, then you're just going to have to ask Perplexity or something like that, you know, how to create an app password for whatever your mail provider is. I don't suggest that you should actually go searching on Rogers or Simpatico site or whatever to find that, because it's usually buried really badly. Ask an AI how to do it. They'll point you to the exact place you have to go. So you can also archive from other sources. So I did it from a live mail server, but I can ingest mail from email clients. So if I wanted to bring in the mail from my local Thunderbird client, I could do that. Or from Outlook installed locally with mail stored locally. Or I can go out to those individual files. I could bring in the mail from a PST file or an inbox file or individual mail files if I wanted. Once you've ingested all the mail, you can access it just like you would as if you were on the live mail system. So here I'm pointing to, under my archive, I'm pointing to my ncf.ca account, and I'm looking at the inbox, and I see the list of all of the subject and date and times it was received. I see the email in a preview window, just as I would see it if I was online accessing that particular mailbox. I can read them. I can print them. No problem at all. There is a search box where you can click in, and you can do a quick search, or you can actually go to the full search, and this is pretty powerful. So here I'm searching for XYZZY. Anybody who's an old gamer understands what that stands for. And then you can say you want to search in subject, message body, attachments, so forth. You can search for in a particular folder. So you could say in this following archive, in my inbox, or a subfolder of my inbox. I only want to search in there. You can do date ranges. So you can say, oh, I only want if it's in the last week or it's older than a year or things like that. Certain sizes. You have lots of search capabilities that are built into the program. So you can also do word fragments, wildcarding, phrases. You can exclude it. So you can say, I want emails that don't include a particular phrase or word. And there's lots of help on how to access the archive, including all of those subsets are available to you. In file attachments, when you're searching, it can actually find the search term in the attachments. In this case here, it found an email that had the XYZZY was actually in a document that was attached to that email. And I could just double-click on that attachment. It'll open it up in the native program. In this case here, it opened up that document, and there was the term XYZZY was in that actual document rather than the email. You can save out your attachments. So right-click on it. Save it out to the file system if that's what you want to do. Then you can export your mail to a different mail server if you want. So this is if you're moving from one mail provider to another and you want all your email from the old provider to be moved over to your new provider. So in this example, I'm going to copy all the email from my National Capital Freenet mailbox over to my Gmail mailbox. So you start off, you say where you're sending the mail to. In this case, I'm sending it to a Gmail. Select which archive you want to send, and you can actually do a subset of it. So you can say, okay, I want within this archive, but I only want my inbox, or I only want a particular folder or whatever. Most cases, you probably just want to bring the whole thing over. Then you get the Gmail mailbox that you're going to have that you're sending the mail to. So I give it the address for that. And then it creates a new profile. And then I double-click on it. It'll actually bring in all of that mail and send it off to my Gmail account. Now when I bring up my Gmail account, I see here I have a label called Mail Store Export, and all my mail from NCF, National Capital Freenet, is now in my Gmail account. Other email programs will normally show it as a folder rather than as a label. And if you reply to those emails that are migrated to your new mailbox, the replies will be from your new email address, which makes sense. You're giving up probably you're giving up an old email address. And because Gmail is, well, Gmail, they don't have folders. You know, they use labels to fake it out. MailStore will see everything when it ingests stuff from a Gmail account. It sees everything as being either inbox or sent items, period. So emails that get moved in Gmail to a label, and they show up only under a label when you're looking at it in Gmail, when you ingest them into MailStore, they will show up as being in your inbox. No other way around it. It doesn't understand the idea of labels within Gmail. Items in trash are never seen or archived by MailStore. If you are moving from Gmail to another email provider, you'll lose what appears to be that folder structure in Gmail. There's no way around that. It'll all be in either inbox or sent items. And since trash is never seen by MailStore, it never gets archived and therefore can't be migrated to a different mail server, other than what you could do as a workaround. In your Gmail account, move the items that are in the trash to a temporary label. You could call it Gmail Trash or something like that. And then because it's not in your trash, it's in a under a label, essentially within your inbox, then MailStore can actually see it. It can archive that those items. But when they get archived, they will show up as being in your inbox as opposed to trash or under a label. And then optionally, you can get rid of everything in that label afterwards within your Gmail account if you want. One more thing, messages never get deleted on the source server. So when you're ingesting new email from a mailbox, it will never actually touch anything that exists on your source mailbox. If you delete things from the server, it will never get deleted from the archive if you do an update to the archive. Okay, and this is something that I'm a little bit, I don't know if I really like that or not. You can manually delete items from your archive, assuming that you can identify which ones you had deleted from your mailbox. The consequence of that is that your archive, if you continuously update it or re-ingest all of the mail, it will grow forever. A workaround for that would be you can just delete the archive and then rebuild it, and it will bring down a fresh copy of your mailbox with the current contents of it at that point in time. So more details on the email deletions. If you're concerned about this sort of thing, by all means, really read this particular webpage. It goes into exhaustive details about how MailStore looks at various items within mailboxes. So how I use MailStore Home, I ingest email now from four different email addresses, and I update them periodically. So maybe once a week or so, I'll go and I'll update all of them. I can quickly search across all my emails, across all my accounts. I can search for emails regardless of where they exist. I can archive all my emails so that if I need to, I can rebuild the mailbox. I never have to, if I ever decide that I want to close any of my mail accounts, I could use MailStore Home to move the email to a new account, or I could just leave it as an archive and just access that email forever from within MailStore Home if I just want it as a reference material or something like that. One additional thing on here. If you want more information about doing emails and things like that, I do give the presentation at the RO Public Library, Ins and Outs. This was one that Alan and I gave in January, I believe it was, main OPCUG meeting. If you're interested in more details about dealing with emails, there's a whole bunch of ones coming up, so come on out for one of those. And I see in one of the things, cost, it's a free program. And Timothy, yes, you are right about XYZZY. And what else do we have? Does it include original attachments? Yes, it brings in the entire email, including original attachments. Can you turn on or off images? Yes, it will obey the same rules as most mail clients will, where if it's got an embedded image that is actually coming from the web, it will not display it by default. You will get a bar that says, we're not displaying the graphics that are embedded in this email. If you want, click here, and then it will bring in the images, just like any decent email program. Will capture nested folders? Yes. With the exception of Gmail, because as I say, Gmail, it doesn't have folders. It has labels. And MailStore, unfortunately, doesn't understand folders at all. So if you're bringing in stuff from Gmail, all your mail will end up in either inbox or sent items. It'll handle multiple Gmail.
Basically said it didn't understand folders. It doesn't understand labels.
MailStore doesn't understand Gmail labels. Yeah, every other program that I've ever come across, or mail server out there, actually has folders, as opposed to the stupid way that Gmail actually deals with it, as these labels. So all other programs, it will understand the folders, and it will obey them or ingest them with those folder structure, but with Gmail, it won't. Handle multiple Gmail accounts, no problem at all. And I think that's all of the questions that I see. So
one more, Chris, which is a bit earlier. Harvey was saying, I'm curious whether the new being in apostrophes, the new Outlook cloud storage is compatible.
I would be willing to bet yes, in that as a minimum, I bet you can access it through IMAP. And so if you can access it through IMAP, it can work. If it doesn't understand IMAP, probably not. But you can always just try the email address as what you want to ingest. And generally speaking, it just figures it out from that. And it knows what it has to do to get the email. But if the email fails on that, that's when try IMAP. If IMAP also fails, it probably is not going to work.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. That looks like a really neat piece of software.
Yeah, it's excellent. And as I say, it touches on a whole lot of pain points that people have with email. So check it out, folks. It's free. It's easy to use. Wonderful program.
How fast is it for
it's
indexing?
Quite fast. For the indexing part, I'm not sure. But ingesting of emails, I did 3,000 in less than 10 minutes. If you do it like 5 minutes later, it'll take just about a minute for it to figure out, you've got one new email, and bring in that one email. The indexing, I've only re-indexed things once where I ingested a bunch of stuff and I didn't have that check for indexing of attachments. So I said, okay, re-index it. And it re-indexed a couple of thousand emails in probably about 15 seconds.
And you can look things up in a second or two.
Oh, yeah, it's very fast on the searching. I found I've got five email accounts, I think, now that I've got ingested in there. And the searching is usually within a second. It's got the results. Very, very fast program.
I was going to ask about the developer and the free software, but France is a bit of a cynic here. She says, what's the catch? Free usually has an issue.
No, actually, in this one there, this is free for personal use. Okay, so
there's a pro version?
Yeah, I don't think it's a pro version. I think there's a commercial version. And so if you're using it within a corporation setting or something like that, it actually costs money then. So, but I don't think there is any catch on the free for personal use side of things. I've certainly not run into anything. It is actually developed by OpenText. And they're a company that deals an awful lot with that searching of contents of things across all kinds of things, file systems, email systems, everything like that. They've been around for a long time. And the fact that they brought it out and they have a long history, that company, it's not a fly-by-night outfit. So I expect that it is going to be around for a long time. And it's a locally installed program anyways. So even if they went out of business, the program will still function. It doesn't depend on OpenText back end to do anything. Once you've installed it, it works no matter what. So it's a great program. Really, really good.
So Jenny's asking, does it archive? I'm not quite sure what that means, because it basically is an archival program.
Yeah, it is. What it's doing is it's calling down copies of all of your emails and putting it all into local stores or a local store that is divvied up within it, just so you can, for an organizational point of view. But yeah, it brings down all of your email, and that is an archive, is the way that they term it. So it's a local copy of all your emails.
And then what about a backup then?
You could back up the folder that this is in. If you install the portable, this is one thing that I think is a little bit of a gotcha. If you do the installable version, it will be on Drive C, and your archives will be on Drive C. If you want them to be elsewhere, install the portable version, and you can install it anywhere. So you could install it to /mail or something like that. And then the program as well as your archive will be in that particular folder. So if you want to back it up, you just back up that folder.
And John's asking if this is a Windows-only program.
As far as I know, yes, it's Windows-only.
And Deborah's saying, would you use it in addition to Outlook or Thunderbird?
I do use it in addition to my regular mail. You can't send mail from MailStore. So you can read mail that has been ingested into it or archived into it. You can print it, search it, and things like that, but you can't send mail from here. So in order to send mail, you'd still have to use your normal, whatever you use now for email, you would continue to use that.
And then Jen's asking if it takes up a lot of space.
No, not a lot at all. I can take a real quick look here and tell you exactly how much space it is taking on mine. I think. Where did I store it? I did the portable version. I can't remember what drive I actually put it onto here. MailStore Home. Okay. It's using, and this is probably about, I'm guessing at this point, maybe about a total of across all the mail stores, about 4,000 or 5,000 emails, a lot with attachments and things like that, and it's taking up a total of a little over 600 megabytes of space. So it's not that huge.
Okay, all right, thanks very much, Chris. Let's move along and get Stuart lined up with his microphone, because Stuart's got some information for us on how to access your medical records in a digital format.
Well, yeah, this is new for my region of Quebec. Well, Quebec in general. But apparently you people in Ontario have had this for some time. And I noticed that it has all the American states listed too. So for the international folks, you might have access to this already as well. It's called MyChart, and it's pretty good as far as it goes for me, which is not very far because it's only been implemented here in my region of Quebec for about a month now. And the only thing I can access once I figured out how to do that was my test results, of which there's quite a few since I've had some issues lately, but there you go, test results. Quebec's on this process of digitizing everything. We're really trying to come to grips with the 20th century still here. But talking to my mother, she said she's been using this for a couple of years now since one of her surgeries. And it's really useful and helpful to her because as well as test results, it apparently tracks her medications and appointments and communications and tells you who accessed your records as well as you and your doctor. So you can chase down that intern who's looking at your x-rays that wasn't supposed to. There's quite a few groups in Canada. I'll focus in on Canada here because I don't know much about the states. There's 15 organizations across Canada that have access to this. And in Ontario, I see Hamilton and Central Eastern Ontario Hospital Cluster, wherever that is. CHEO, Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario, and the Ottawa Hospital. And there's a few others here, Hamilton, and like I mentioned, Mackenzie Health. Cleveland Clinic Canada, which just confuses me. I didn't think Cleveland was in Canada, but whatever. Anyway, this is a great way to get access to some of your medical information that previously you had to make an appointment or sell a kidney to get access to from your local hospital, and it's available online through the MyChart.org webpage, and they have apps for Android and iPhone. So you can have it in your pocket as well as on your desktop. All your medical history. And again, I'm not the best person to talk about all the advantages and disadvantages of it because there's very limited information so far in the Quebec version. But you folks where the program has been around for longer may have more information available to you. Anybody else here using it? Hey.
Yes, I've been using it for a while.
There you
go. I use it too. I was just on it last night.
Yeah, so was I.
Pocket Health, I found,
is a better one, though, because it actually gives you the scans and images and everything.
Anyway.
Yeah, I found it invaluable when my...
Natalie mentioned in there that in Ottawa, we've got two hospital streams. And so the Ottawa Hospital in Chiel uses MyChart. And then the Queensway Carleton and Mulfour and maybe something else use a similar thing called Connected Care. And never the two shall talk.
Well, no, you wouldn't want that.
Oh, God, no. And then somebody mentioned Pocket Health, which is good, yeah. But it doesn't, you know, which is fantastic, but it doesn't give you the appointments and stuff like that.
Yeah, and then there's another one called Ocean, which is a real piece of work.
Anyway, this one is government approved, and seeing as our governments are usually the ones controlling our health care, at least in Canada. Again, I don't know about the U.S. That's some bizarre place to me. I really don't understand how it works. Just the more money you have, the better off you are, I think, for health care. But if it's a government approved system, then you'll probably get the best results that you can get quickly. I'm looking forward to it being more developed and more useful to me.
One thing that's cool, too, in Ottawa is that DynaCare is connected to it. So if you're going to DynaCare for blood work, which I do a fair amount, yes, you can use DynaCare Plus to look at results, but now they send it to MyChart, and it shows up in MyChart sooner than it does in DynaCare.
There you go. So, if you're not using it, folks, and you have any health issues, I suggest you take a look at the website or the app. Because I did. I have a bugger of a time finding it. I tell you, you know, they made a big hoo-ha about this new implementation of the digitizing of our healthcare records in certain regions of Quebec. And there was no information on how to access this. So finally, I'm reading an article in one of the online newspapers. And there's a picture of someone holding a phone and smiling in the article. So I zoomed in on the phone, and I could just make out MyChart. So I searched online, and I thought, oh, MyChart.org, by God. They wouldn't tell us. I had to hunt for it, but that's the system. I guess they don't want too many users accessing it right off the bat.
Can you hear me?
Just.
Is my chart mostly for the patient, or do the medical staff also use it? Because I've had blood tests done as well, or a friend of mine has, who was in and out of hospital for a couple of years, and the whole chart is taken up with hundreds of blood tests that don't need to stay there forever. I'm just wondering if we could delete them, or if that's...
Oh, I don't know. I don't think you'll be able to delete things as a user, but everybody's got access to it.
Okay. You have,
but it is your information, and you should have the right to ask for things to be deleted if they're no longer relevant.
And do you have access to Life Labs and My Care Compass? That's for blood work as well.
Huh. Yeah, for my chart, it's also used by the health professionals. They call it Epic, though. I'm not sure. I know it's the same thing.
Epic is the company. Epic is the company that makes it.
In the U.S., they tend to call it Epic. But they've got a certain retention period. They keep there, and that's it. And I can't remember what it is. I've seen it with mine because stuff disappears. But we're talking years.
Doctors like to see back years and years and years. Because it shows what your body is kind of like itself.
It's helpful for them.
Also, Epic is the company in the U.S. that runs My Chart, and they say they have 190 million people, so they are quite large. So there's also a recent podcast on the founder of it. I'll try to find it and put it in at least the forum, if not the chat.
DynaPlus is a subscription service, too. It's not free. You have to pay. It's not very much. I think it's almost $10, I think, for the subscription. So it's not very expensive.
Oh. That's basically all I've got. If anybody else has anything pertinent, fire away.
Okay, thank you very much, Stuart. Few people using systems a bit like that. Okay, 8:15. Chris, are you going to do your app control?
Sure, I can get it done in under 15 minutes. I'll sort of rush through it a little bit, but it's kind of an interesting thing. App control, I gave a presentation on this in, March? And it really is a replacement for the Windows Task Manager. Task Manager is very much a point-in-time look at things. The biggest thing App Control brings to the table is that it'll give you historical data on the resource usage on your computer. So you can see over time, and it can be up to 3 days of historical data, that you can see what's going on your computer. So a very useful app. And, what if App Control could be supercharged with AI? And, of course, everybody's building AI into everything, so isn't everything better with AI? And just a paraphrase of Big Bang Theory, Penny had a little business making these hair barrettes, and the guys were trying to figure out how to make them more appealing to men, and Penny said, how are flower barrettes going to appeal to men? Howard says, we add Bluetooth. Well, we add AI. And Sheldon, of course, says, Penny, everything is better with Bluetooth. So isn't everything better with AI? And in this case, maybe it is. So a little bit of a deep dive. But I can figure this stuff out, so I figure you can probably do it as well. It's not that difficult. It is a multi-step process to get this set up to do what I'm going to be showing you. But when I started, I wasn't really sure what it was I was doing, but I just followed the instructions, and it worked out fine. So what you have is App Control with the ability to tie that into AI agents that will actually look up information that it can get from App Control. So the strapline from App Control website, it says, your PC behaviors finally have answers. You just have to ask. So it's a really good way that you can look at the historical resource usage on your computer and get useful information out of it. It can connect to your favorite AI agents, whatever your favorite AI agents are, like Claude, Cursor, WinServe, and so forth. I highlighted Claude in red because at least to start with, just go with Claude because their instructions are the clearest for it, and it just follow that along. If you want to go to another AI later on, fill your boots, but start with Claude. So no more digging through logs and no more guessing about what is going on your computer. You just get instant answers about resource usage. So what you have to do is you download App Control version 1.2 or greater. I think they're up to 1.3 now. And configure it for the maximum retention of data. So currently that's 3 days. I've asked for it to be extended. We'll see if that happens. Read a web page that talks about how this ties together. and then follow the instructions at that web page. And I will paste all of this into the chat before I forget about it again. There we go. So currently I recommend that you use the feature with Cloud Desktop for Windows and use the standard configuration as it is outlined on the App Control website. Then what? So you've got those things installed and you run Cloud Desktop for Windows and you just start asking questions. So how about this? What unsigned applications have been running on the system? So unsigned applications could be an indication of a piece of software that is malware, because it's extremely rare to have a signed application that is actually malware. There's some additional risk. So do I want to know what unsigned applications have been running on my system? So Cloud comes back with data that got surfaced by the App Control program. And so it comes up with what's currently running on the system. And then it has previously run, but no longer active. So something that was maybe running yesterday or something like that. And it flags things that are of interest. So in this case here, we're looking at the first one where I highlighted in yellow where it showed something that was currently running and it highlighted a note on it. And it said cursorhighlighter.exe is running from Google Drive. And this is worth noting. And why? And App Control by itself wouldn't surface this information. It just, you know, it says that you got something running. But down in the few things worth flagging, it says executables running from a cloud sync folder are unusual, could be a security concern if that folder is shared or synced from another machine. And yeah, of course, if I share that folder with somebody else and they replace my cursorhighlighter.exe with malware, the next time my program, my computer tries to run it, it's going to run the malware. So there is a risk to that. I know that, so I wasn't particularly concerned about it. Number four, Brother printer software is unsigned. You think, oh, that's not good. But then they say, surprisingly common for older printer drivers, low risk but notable. So it gives you a little bit more insight into what's actually going on. So I think that's pretty cool. How about, what apps have used my webcam in the past 24 hours? And it comes up and it says, Zoom access it. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Zoom accessing my webcam. But what about svchost.exe? Was actually accessing my webcam. And I think, what's that? It's the Windows host process. What's it doing accessing my webcam? So it goes on to explain it. And it says that, oh, many background services, including things like Windows Hello facial recognition, use the SVC host to actually access the camera. It says the two rapid back-to-back accesses in the early morning could be Windows Hello unlocking the screen after idle. Nothing here looks alarming. All accesses were by legitimate signed software. Gives me warm, fuzzy feelings. So I do have a webcam that does Windows Hello, so that makes sense to me. App Control figured out the what? Cloud AI figured out the why. What are the most recent app updates on my computer? What applications are being updated automatically on my computer? And it came up with a huge list of things, including Malwarebytes got updated 5 times in a single day. I thought, wow, that's a little bit unusual. But it goes on to say, everything looks normal. You know, legitimate publishers, Malwarebytes, updating throughout the day. That's just normal incremental updates to the threat intelligence. So, again, gives me good information. A few things worth noting about low concern. New unsigned binaries seen, all benign. New services added, all legitimate. Bottom line, no signs of malicious or suspicious and malicious activity. The system looks clean. Gives me the warm, fuzzy feelings that my computer is in good shape. What apps that are currently auto-starting with Windows on my computer should I remove from auto-starting to speed up Windows and only start them when I need it? So it came up, and it came up with a list of processes that it thought it should happen. Now, first off, any of these things that is querying the App Control data, it will come up and ask you this once. So Claude wants to access the list processes from App Control. I just do always allow. And then in the future, it doesn't bug me with this question. So in this case here, it says safe to remove from startup. It had some recommendations on that. Now, it had a couple that I thought, I wonder a little bit about. Brother Control Center, only needed when scanning or using advanced printer functions. Okay. If that's the case, I could remove it and just run it when I actually want to do something that requires that app to be running, which is typically things like scanning from the printer. And then it said UniGet UI, and it said that it only needs to run when you're managing or updating software. I thought, that doesn't sound quite right to me. So I went and I said, first off, on the Brother Control Center, I said, it's auto-starting with Windows. What's the resource usage impact, including memory, CPU, and disk? So it is auto-starting with Windows, but is it a big deal? So it came back and it said, the actual RAM usage isn't directly measurable through app control. Expect roughly 30 to 60 megabytes. And I thought, that's curious, because I said, why can't app control tell you the amount of RAM used by those processes? If I search for them within app control, it actually lists them, and it says it's 224 kilobytes and 1.1 megabytes. And I said, oh, you're right. I just didn't query for it. My mistake. And he says, you know, the rough estimate was actually way, way off. He said the 224 kilobytes and 1.1 megabytes, remarkably low, far less than I estimated, definitely not a meaningful reason to remove them from startup. So you can't believe everything that Claude tells you. How about safe to remove from startup? Get UniGet UI. And it says it only needs to run when you're managing or updating software. Well, I know that it actually periodically checks by itself, and by default it'll be like every couple of hours. It'll see if there are any updates to any of your programs. So I said, if I remove UniGet UI from startup apps, will it still automatically check for updates? And it said, oh, no, it won't. It will not start automatically, and it has. If you remove it from startup, it simply won't run until you manually start it. And so there are no other mechanisms on my computer that are going to kick in to actually run it, like a scheduled task or something like that. And it basically came back and said, yeah, leave it in the startup. So their recommendation originally on it was probably not the best. And then there were some things about the my Razer mouse and wanted the impact on it. And so it went in and it actually built these charts to show the memory usage over time and the CPU utilization over time. And so I could look at that and I could say, you know, is this an impact that I care about or not? And they came down to the bottom line of saying removing it from startup would be a real win for available memory. So I said, well, I have 32 gigs of RAM. Is the savings in RAM really significant? I said, oh, no. You know, 150 megabytes on a 32 gigabyte system is less than 0.5% of total RAM. You'll never notice it in practice. Removing it saves a bit of clutter, but not a lot of RAM resources. So you can't trust it all the way, but you can query it, and you can decide, okay, want a little bit more depth on this, and it'll re-reason things. Another one, it said, consider removing widgets. Well, I hate Windows widgets, so I said, yeah, I want to get rid of widgets. And it said how to disable things that are running in the startup. And it said that you go to Task Manager, and you go to Startup Apps, right-click on each app and choose Disable. But Windows widgets don't show up in Startup Apps. So I said I could not find Windows widgets in the Startup Apps. And they said, oh, that's because it's not a traditional Startup App. And they tell me how I can actually go about disabling widgets in Windows 11. So I could do that, no problem at all. So you have to work with it a little bit, but eventually you can get all of these answers. In the past week, what programs use the most CPU for the longest periods of time? Well, Google Chrome, by far the heaviest load. That's because I usually have about 20 tabs open in Google Chrome, so not a big deal for me. But then it had Malwarebytes. You know, that's my main antivirus that I'm running currently on this system. And so it gives you a little bit of details about, you know, what is the impact on your system. Now, I just want to leave it there. That's fine. I was going to query some more, but this is where I got, out of free messages with Claude. And so Claude is a service that you can use for free for a little bit, and then it'll cut you off, and then you have to come back the next day and continue on. So it's not cheap if you want to actually upgrade. It's like $24 a month Canadian for Claude. So I'm not about to spend that kind of money. I'll just come back the next day. Another day I came back and I saw PowerShell was using consistently high CPU, averaging 2.9 to 3.3% of the CPU all day. I thought, wow, that's kind of heavy. And I said, tell me what's using PowerShell so much. And it came up and it said, oh, it's mostly the Windows Task Scheduler. And it highlighted the tasks that are using a lot. Lenovo Vantage, so Lenovo computer I have, said that it's scheduled tasks executing periodically. So I said, okay, give me a PowerShell script to list all the scheduled tasks from Lenovo sorted by the last run. And it gave me a script. I ran it. And it gave me a list of 32 separate tasks that are on my computer that Lenovo put there that are running periodically. 21 of them were run in the past 2 days. Now, I should probably go through each of those tasks and see, do I really need that task, or is it something that I really don't care about? You know, it wakes up, it does some check or something like that, and then it goes away again. So in all likelihood, it's not going to be an overly huge impact on the performance of my computer, but I could go through each of those individual tasks and say, how much is the impact of those tasks? So in summary, I think that adding AI to app control really, really is a good thing. So, you know, you can deduce through AI what the data really means that app control is actually looking at, if it gives you the right interpretation. And as we saw, it doesn't always, so sometimes you have to challenge it a little bit. So I have suggested some changes to app control that are being considered. I want more guides on how to make it a little bit easier to connect to other free AIs. Claude is fine, but it does cut you off at a certain point. You have to come back the next day. Lengthening the maximum period for data collection. 3 days, I think, is a little bit low. Allowing a user to move those logs, that data, to another drive rather than the C drive would be a nice addition as well. So those are all being considered. So to me, the integration of App Control and Claude AI is really, really intriguing. It really is useful. And as the AIs get smarter, I think that things will only get better. And I think that's it. Out of all of this, I had 6 that were advice or reasoning that it gave me that were good. 2 were maybe not so good. 1, UniGet UI, to me that was a really bad suggestion that it had to take that out of the auto start. But that's not too bad out of it all. And hopefully the AIs will just get smarter. And that's it.
Oh, Glenn's asking if you can use Copilot instead of Claude. Does they have instructions for that one?
I don't believe they do. There's an open source methodology an API of sorts that you can use to tie in app control to an AI. So if your AI supports that, then yes, you can. But they don't provide an awful lot of guidance for anything other than using it with Claude currently. So it may be possible, but I really don't know.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. We've hit the magic hour, so I'm going to skip any other questions. We've had a lot of discussion and questions. And moving on to the 5 presentations that are coming up, I think Quick PC Tips at Nepean Centerpoint on Saturday is probably a go.
Yep.
But I don't think the next 2 are.
That's true.
Yeah, definitely The first one has been canceled, and likely the second one will be canceled as well.
So if you're interested in Linda's presentations, you should register for them because they're getting canceled due to lack of registrants. And we do have other presentations available if you go to that link. You can register for Chris's on Saturday, but you can also take a look at what else is available and register for any of the other upcoming presentations. Okay, coming up for us, for members, we have our pizza queue, which is in Britannia Park on the 10th. If you want to attend and you haven't already done so, please send Harvey an email and tell him how many people are coming, you plus guests, members plus guests, and what kind of pizza you would like to have, and whatever else he needs to know. Details on the URL there. otherwise, next week we have another Q&A session, so if you do have questions that we haven't asked tonight, if you have follow-up on the things we've discussed, or if you have specific topics that you'd like to share, just send us a few details to suggestion box at opcud.ca, and we'll be happy to create some space in next week's agenda. So I hope we'll see you next week. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.
Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.